Kelly Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. And coming up, have you made an effort to support local farmers this summer? We talk with two Wisconsin farm owners about what it's been like to operate a farm during a pandemic. Up now, our next guest looked back at 100 years of American experience with the disease diabetes, what she started out looking for and what she found and then ended up pursuing in her new book. They're just not the same things. She challenges the framework of thinking about this disease and something that we can understand as simply affecting one race or one group of people disproportionately. There have been historically a variety of reasons to chalk up having diabetes to differences among races, but biology is not the whole story. And here to tell us about it is Arlene Marcia Tuckman. She's the Nelson O. Tyrone Jr. Professor of History and former director of the Center for Medicine, Health and Society at Vanderbilt University. And we should note she received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And her latest book is called Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease. Arlene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
We're happy to have you here. We do want to start way at the beginning, though, because you actually set out to tell more of the story of type 2 diabetes, and then you didn't end up writing that book. Why didn't it work?
Well, I realized at one point while I was doing my research that they didn't distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Officially, they didn't make the distinction until the late 1970s. Probably a few decades before, there was a lot of discussion that they might be two different kinds of disease. But certainly in the time that I began in the late 19th century and for the first half of the 20th, they believed that diabetes was one disease. They certainly were aware that if you developed it when you were young, your prognosis was much worse. You would probably die within a few years. And if you developed it when you were middle-aged or elderly, that you had a much better prognosis. But they thought of it as one disease. So that I ended up realizing that it would be anachronistic for me to think that I was writing a book of type 2, just about type 2 diabetes.
What inspired you in the first place? Because your other books, they're not about diabetes.
Correct. Well, as an historian of medicine, I had long been interested in the history of disease. And the deciding factor was when my dad moved to Nashville in 2002. He had been diagnosed with diabetes in the 1980s when he was 65. And interestingly, he was misdiagnosed. They assumed he had type 2 diabetes. He was 65, and age is a risk factor. He was short and rather overweight. And so they assumed that he had type 2 diabetes. It took about a year and a different physician until they realized that he had a rarer form of diabetes called LADA, or latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood, which has similarities to type 1. So his body did not produce any insulin. And from that point, for the remaining 28 years of his life, he injected insulin four times a day.
You used the word assumed there, that people assumed, physicians assumed that this was his disease. And your book really is about all of the assumptions that we make when we think about diabetes and who it affects.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the irony didn't escape me that had my dad been diagnosed 100 years earlier, it would have seemed perfectly natural that my dad had diabetes because we're Jewish, and the assumption in the late 19th century and well into the 20th century was that the population that was most at risk of developing diabetes was white people in general and Jews in particular. There was even a belief that people of who were African American, Native American, that they had an immunity.
And you take different pieces of your book to try to tackle this idea that certain people have immunity or certain people are more predisposed simply by genetics, because it's not just about genetics. It goes beyond our genetic makeup.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, even before genes were actually discovered, right, they were still talking about biological traits. So one of the arguments in my book is that as researchers noticed that diabetes was distributed unevenly among different populations that they viewed as races, when they saw these health disparities, that consistently they explained these disparities by pointing either to the biology or genetics or to the behaviors of the particular racial groups. Mm-hmm. And that shifted over the course of the 20th century from believing that, as I mentioned, that whites and particularly Jews were most likely to develop diabetes to viewing Native Americans as most susceptible, African Americans, and then Hispanic Americans. And the explanations always focused on the biology and behavior of those populations.
And why are you finding that's not true?
Well, I want to give my historical actors some credit. There was always a minority of voices who argued that that one had to pay attention to the living conditions, whether it was poverty or discrimination. So Jews who and Jewish physicians who actually accepted that they had a higher rate of diabetes claimed that it was because of the millennia of discrimination that they had been subjected to that made their nervous system somewhat unstable and made them susceptible to nervous diseases. What's really important about this is that nervous diseases were considered to be diseases of civilization, that only those who were most advanced had the most developed nervous system. And the downside of that is that it it made it more likely that you would develop a nervous disease.
Arlene Tuckman has written a book about diabetes and the factors that play roles in whose bodies actually develop this disease. And there's room for you in this conversation here on Central Time. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What changes would you like to see in how we think about disease and race as a culture or as a community? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. Arlene, a lot of your writing deals with race and really racism. So yes. How did that become intertwined with diabetes?
So the explanations, as I mentioned, that always looked to racial traits and to behaviors that were linked with particular races, that always masked what was going on around the communities that were suffering so much. So what interests me is how people are living in particular conditions that make them sick. And yet when the medical community or the public health community, but also popular writers, so in newspapers and magazines, when they try and explain why a particular population had a high rate, they are ignoring all of the factors that are products of racism, and they are attributing the high disease rates to the biology and behaviors of the population.
Then how much can we attribute to doctors, to political leaders, white or non-white Americans using certain language when thinking or talking about diabetes?
How much can we?
I guess, for lack of a better word, how much can we blame them? I mean, how much of this is a part, how much of it, you know, matters the way that we talk about it, you know, when we have facts?
Yeah. So I really would like to get away from the language of blame because I want to get away from what really predominates today, but has always been part of the way that we look at disease, and I would say especially diabetes, and that is our inclination to blame people for being sick. So maybe what I would say is that physicians are a part of our culture, and they always have been. They are not immune from the kinds of language and representations that circulate through our society. So we have to stop thinking that by virtue of something being medical or even having a disease label, that it is neutral. In fact, diseases really are sites where false claims about a population's racial makeup get absorbed and they get reproduced. So I think in terms of what goes on within the clinical encounter, it would be really wonderful if medical schools would do some anti-racism training. I'm sure some are. And just ramp it up. We all heard recently about the Ohio state senator who lost his job as an emergency room physician because he blamed high COVID rates among African American people on the fact that they don't wash their hands enough. And that kind of statement, we know that he spoke it out loud, but that others are also thinking this, and we have to tackle that.
Yeah. Arlene, thank you for that framing, that way to think about it. We're talking with Arlene Tuckman. She's written a book about diabetes and how race and really racism play a role in whose bodies have to cope with this disease. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection with this history of diabetes? Do you have the disease? When were you diagnosed? And what has your experience been like? We want to bring you into this conversation, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. We're talking about diabetes and not just how our genes influence whether we'll deal with the disease, but also how race and class and other circumstances factor into our risk. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Arlene Tuckman is our guest, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest who studied the history of this disease? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. And we'll go ahead now and take a caller. Anne from Waukesha is on the line and wants to join our conversation. Hi, Anne.
Hi, you guys. Thank you for having this conversation. I have history of diabetes and have been insulin dependent since for the last, I would say, 5 years. I have a father who had it, a great-grandfather who died of Bright's disease, which is what they called, I guess, the kidney disease. And I'm really struggling with the cost right now of treating the disease. I know historically it couldn't be treated, but now it can be treated, but the expense of insulin is extraordinary. I wonder if you could comment on that.
And thank you so much for bringing up treatment and the cost of managing this. And, Arlene, what do you think here?
Yeah. There really isn't a treatment for diabetes, as I'm sure you know. What we have developed over time are better and better ways of managing the disease and managing the highs and the lows. And you're absolutely right. The cost of treatment is horrendous. And the more advanced technologies that we have are like pumps. They're just out of reach for individuals who are not very comfortable financially. And I think this just points to how much we need to have an overhaul of our healthcare system and to have universal care and to healthcare and to be able to negotiate reasonable drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies.
Because when we're talking about people who can't afford the different ways that you manage diabetes, we're talking about class, which also plays into every piece of the history of what we know about diabetes.
Yes, absolutely. And poverty is a big part of how diabetes has been reimagined. What I would like to add to this is that people who are living in poverty, no matter what their skin color, are with many of the same issues. But when we're talking about populations of color, we have to also pay attention to the physiological, the biological effects of racism. And that when you are confronted in every aspect of your life with racist practices and racist policies and racist beliefs, you often develop chronic stress. And we know that chronic stress produces, dumps more cortisol into your system, and this increases your risk of developing chronic diseases. So, you know, I grew up talking about the difference between nature and nurture, but research that demonstrates that our environment can directly alter our biological, our physiological state, then that just explodes that that distinction.
We are talking with Arlene Tuckman, who's written a book about diabetes and the factors that play into who gets it and how we manage it. And there's room for you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. James from Appleton wants to join us. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I got diabetes about a year ago, type 2. And when I was in the ER being diagnosed, the emergency room doctor was really pushing for insulin and that I should be on insulin the rest of my life. Having read a book on diabetes and having a mother who was a diabetic, I chose diet and exercise, and now 80 pounds down and a year later, I don't take any pills, and I just manage it with diet and exercise, and it can be done. You don't have to be reliant on the medicine or the pills if you're willing to do what needs to be done to get it, you know, to get it under control.
Yeah, James, congratulations on that work for sure. It worked for James. But Arlene, James talks about a significant weight loss, and that brings us back to the idea, the assumptions about obesity and diabetes. And there's a medical connection, but it's not always what we think.
Yeah. Also, congratulations. That's really wonderful news. And what I would like to say about this is that we do have a way of thinking about diabetes as a diabetes over which people have choices, around which people have choices. And that if they just decide to exercise and eat well, then they can lose weight and no longer have the symptoms of diabetes. But that whole frame assumes that you have the resources to do that. It assumes that you have enough control over your daily activities, that you're not trying to manage how to live on unemployment or how to live on food stamps. It is developed within a framework of people being able to get to supermarkets and buy healthy foods. And so I actually think that this language of choosing is what feeds into a language of blaming. And what I would really prefer to see is that we pay attention to all of the constraints that people are struggling with that make it difficult for them to make the kinds of choices that we know can improve our health. So it's just not the same when you're living in deep poverty as when you have access to resources.
And this relates somewhat to Charlie called in to ask if there's a difference in the way diabetes is managed in other countries that don't have the racial problems that America does. Arlene?
I'm not an expert on that. Certainly in other countries, and I would say what's more important is whether there's universal health care, and then also what kind of attention and what kind of financial investment is placed in public health. But there are lots of other countries where they may not have the racial problems, but they certainly have stark class differences. Mm.
What do we need to do then to free ourselves from the assumptions that we've pointed out, to really push ourselves to think about this differently and break this chain of race-related diagnosis of diabetes?
Well, I think we have to change how we think about disease causation. We have to stop blaming, and we need to do what we can to create conditions that help people make healthy choices. I don't know if I have time to give an example here,
sure.
But I would like to say that when I think about the parallels to COVID-19, we have a long history of explaining health disparities by blaming particular racial traits. We also have a long history of counter arguments. So where small groups would try to draw attention to discrimination and to poverty. But that latter argument has had a really hard time gaining traction. There were moments like during the civil rights movement and the war on poverty, but then the Reagan era came and all of that was dismantled. And I'd say we're at a similar crossroads today. The question is, what will happen post-COVID? And I just want to give one example of how racist beliefs become part of how we normalize our conversation around COVID-19.
Yeah, we have about 20 seconds, Arlene. Go ahead.
Okay. We have to stop blaming high rates of COVID-19 on high rates of diabetes and other comorbidities. All of them stem from the same environmental and social conditions that make people sick. Mm.
Thank you for that. Arlene, we've really appreciated this conversation. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. I was glad to be here.
Arlene Marcia Tuckman is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. Her new book out this month is called Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease. Coming up after the news, we hear from two Wisconsin farmers about how the pandemic has affected their 2020 season. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We know that it can be tough to keep up with the current events in a 24-hour news cycle. Tune in to Central Time on Wednesdays for our look at the week in Washington, and on Fridays for our Wisconsin News Roundup for some interesting local stories from around the state. All that and more here on Central Time.
Now, TV shows and movies are full of portrayals of jury trials. Whether it's a panel of citizens listening to compelling evidence presented by attorneys and witnesses, or thoughtful, sometimes heated deliberations taking place as members of the jury argue for what they feel is the most just and appropriate verdict, we probably all have an image in our heads.
But our next guest says that the constitutional right to be judged by a panel of your peers is in danger of disappearing, and that fewer and fewer cases actually go to trial, let alone before a jury.
Drury Sherrod is the co-founder of Mattson and Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategy and jury selection. He's a member of the American Society of Trial Consultants, the American Psychological Association, and the Society for Experimental Social Psychology. He's a prolific author, and his latest book is The Jury Crisis: What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Drury, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Where does the right to be tried by a jury of our peers come from?
It comes from the Magna Carta originally. It originated in little Anglo-Saxon villages about 900 years ago. And then over the years, it was brought to America of the colonies and then as part of the United States Constitution. So the Sixth and Seventh Amendment in the Constitution guarantee the right to trial by jury. One pertains to criminal trials, one pertains to civil trials.
And so we're talking a millennium ago in England. What did it look like then to be tried by a jury of your peers?
Fairly different from what we know as a jury trial today. Originally, there was the king's officer would ride into town assemble a group of local men. They were always men. They were of similar status. And then they would, there were no evidence. There were no witnesses. There were no cross-examinations or examinations. These local villagers would simply discuss together what they had heard about the person. Take a typical Anglo-Saxon named Godric. They would talk about old Godric, and they would say, well, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would do this. Or somebody else would say, he's starting to change, I've heard. So they would talk about an hour or so and then reach a verdict. And for many centuries, that was the nature of trial by jury. It was called self-informing jurors, that they didn't listen to evidence. They just judged based on what they knew about the alleged the person who was accused of a problem.
And then bringing it up to today in the United States, who do we think of as a peer for someone who has been charged with a crime?
It's a huge problem. The courts have over and over defined it, said that what we have in the U.S. is a jury of one's peers. But it's very hard to know what is a peer. There's lots of problems. One is that most people who, 15% of people never receive a jury summons because they've changed address or haven't left a new address or something like that. Another, about 12% receives a summons and ignores it. That you already take about a quarter or a third off it, off the sample. And then when people come to trial, jury selections are, you know, often people get excuses pretty easily, especially in state courts where judges are elected. So judges don't want to be unpopular. There are lots of strikes. Attorneys can strike a juror for cause if the juror admits that they're too biased to be on the trial. Also, jurors are struck with peremptory strikes when an attorney just would say, I don't like the way that person is looking at me.
Hmm. You write that fewer and fewer cases are going to trial at all. Why would that be?
Well, that is the crisis, the jury crisis today. The exact figures are about, this is amazing, 0.5% of all the civil trials that ever are filed in a year ever see a jury. That's 0.5%. That's down from about 20 to 25% in the 1980s. And if you look at criminal trials, it's less than 1% of all criminal trials filed in a year ever see a jury. So that's been referred to, I think you used the phrase, the death of trial by jury, or the vanishing jury, or the disappearing jury.
And why is that? Why would that change so much in a relatively short amount of time?
Partly is that jurors have developed a bad reputation. Jurors are demeaned, dismissed, denigrated, their verdicts ridiculed. Now, invariably, whenever I work with attorneys on jury trials, someone mentions the McDonald's coffee case, which was widely seen as a nutty verdict, that a lady who spilled coffee was awarded $2.7 million in damages. There's lots more to the story that makes it somewhat more plausible. But one of the big reasons is that jurors, there are all these high-profile celebrity trials. For example, in the first Bill Cosby case where he was tried for sexual assault, jurors deliberated for 52 hours, which was longer than even the length of the evidence. And they spent a whole day, they said, when they were interviewed afterwards by reporters, they spent a whole day debating the meaning of reckless. And finally sent a note to the judge to define reckless. And the judge wrote back that they had to use their own common sense understanding of what it meant. Hmm. So jurors are mistrusted. Jurors often don't seem to be able to perform what's required of them in terms of understanding evidence, arriving at a reasonable verdict, engaging in deliberations that are what are expected as deliberations.
So does that mean that lawyers are then counseling their clients to, for instance, take a plea or opt for a bench trial or somehow trying to avoid actually having their case go in front of a jury?
That's exactly what's happening. In criminal trials, plea bargaining has replaced trial by jury. In civil trials, that's when corporations sue each other or a person sues a corporation. In civil trials, they either settle or it goes into what's called ADR, alternative dispute resolution, which is where the case is turned over to mediators or arbitrators. And I bet in almost any contract you've signed or whenever you're on the web and you click that little box that says agree to terms, you're agreeing to waive your right to trial by jury if you have a dispute with a product you ordered. Or say if the cell phone contracts are notorious. I looked at my cell phone contracts and noticed that in three different places in large, black, oversized type, it requires you to waive your right to trial by jury and agree to binding arbitration.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He is an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and his latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we did ask our listeners, Drury, on Facebook to tell us about their experiences of being on juries. Paul on Facebook said, seems to work just fine in my county, and he said it's Racine County here in Wisconsin. Dave on Facebook said, I was the foreman on a jury for a civil case. I thought the system worked well. We shared our views and came up with what we felt was a just verdict. And so it's interesting because granted, it's just two anecdotal comments, but there's the perception, like you said, of, you know, for instance, that McDonald's coffee, a hot coffee case, there's a perception of maybe a system that's gone off the rails, but then some people who are actually involved in jury deliberations say, yeah, actually, you know, it worked pretty well.
I think actually when people tell me what can they do to get off a jury trial, I tell them you really should be on the jury. And often people find it ennobling. It really, it's a moral experience for them, and they learn to sit down and deliberate with people they would never probably come across and talk to in real life. But I think it works as, if we didn't have juries, it would be bad for democracy. Trial by jury is a stepping stone on the whole goal of a democratic culture, I think.
You come at jury selection and trial strategy from a psychological perspective, and you say that the ways trials are run, how evidence is presented, and what we ask of members of a jury really runs counter to how our human minds work. How is that? What's the mismatch there?
There's so much research on how jurors actually make decisions, and it's generally called the story model of jury decision-making. And through lots of experimental research, they find actually when jurors first start hearing about a case, they begin telling a story. Like the way people understand what happened in a case is to match it to a similar event in their own life. And so very early in any kind of case, the jurors will start telling a story. And surprisingly, about two-thirds of jurors in most cases have decided how to vote on the verdict during the opening statement before they've heard any evidence at all. And partly this is because a lot of psychologists, including Daniel Kahneman, who's the founder of behavioral economics, a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, economist, he said that the brain evolved to jump to conclusions based on narratives that we draw from our own lives, not on methodical analytic evaluation of evidence. So we have this built-in bias to jump to a conclusion. We jump to that conclusion early in the opening statement, and then that influences what we attend to during the cases in chief and how we recall it. And when we sit down to deliberate, it influences the stories we tell to our fellow jurors.
And I'm guessing then, as we hear different testimonies or items of evidence, and whether it's coming from the prosecution or the defense, if completely unconsciously we've already started making a decision, the things that agree with us are the things that stick. That confirmation bias comes through.
It's partly because we actually see different worlds without even realizing it. We did a nice study in my jury research firm. We had done lots of auto defect allegation cases. So we ran a huge study with about 5,000 subjects to see how plaintiff jurors in an auto defect case differ from defense jurors. And plaintiff jurors actually saw different worlds. They had more experience with accidents or injuries. They feared injury. They doubted they could protect themselves from injuries. They evaluated risk and harm differently. So you can see how in a case where jurors had to decide if an automobile was defectively designed or not, if they start off appraising the nature of risk and the nature of danger and the nature of harm and hazard entirely differently, they're going to have a hard time sitting down to deliberate.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He's an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and he's the author of the book, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them.
And we want to hear from you. Have you ever served on a jury? What was that experience like? How hard was it to sort through the information you were given and to understand the legal aspect of the case? Did you feel right about the verdict that was returned? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with trial strategy and jury selection expert Drury Sherrod. His book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them.
And we want to hear from you. If you've ever been on trial, would you rather have a jury or a judge decide your fate? If you've served on a jury, was the experience what you expected it to be? For better or worse, do you feel like you have a more realistic idea of how our justice system works? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
And Drury, you talked about how jurors process information as stories, not just as facts that they accumulate, and then at the end they make your decision. What about the issue of having to understand some fairly arcane legal points, as you were saying, the jurors in the first Bill Cosby trial? How does that play into this?
I think the important thing about stories that I would like to make sure that it's clear is that if attorneys see a jury trial as a contest between stories, not as a contest between evidence, but as a contest between stories, then it's incumbent on the attorneys to organize the evidence into stories. And the story model of jury research shows that jurors are much more persuaded by a narrative organization of evidence than a chronological. Typically, what most attorneys will do is have a yellow pad, maybe 50 points, they just check off each one, and they'll say, this witness will testify about this point, another witness will testify about this point. Then as the witnesses are called, they appear out of order, more or less when it's convenient for them to fly in. It's very hard for the juror's brain to assemble all that information. So one of my main recommendations in the book is for attorneys to think like jurors, to think like storytellers, rather than like law school professors who are presenting evidence.
And you said that a large proportion of jurors actually begin or even complete making their decision during the opening statements. And it seems to me like the opening statements and probably the closing statements are the most narrative parts of the trial.
Actually, there are three opportunities. There's the pre-voir dire overview, when the attorney gets to explain to jurors something about what the case is about. So when they're questioned during voir dire, they'll be able to say something like, that happened to me, and I'm already biased in this case. I can't be a good juror. The other place is the opening statements, and that's where the jurors begin to make up their minds, two-thirds to three-quarters before the evidence. And then the final, you would think, closing arguments would be another time to try to persuade jurors. But by then, jurors have firmly made up their minds. Closing arguments don't do much to change their minds. The closing arguments should be used to retell the story and point out how each of the witnesses fits into the total story.
Brandy on Facebook said she was called for jury duty twice in 2 months, never before, never since. And she says, I think the main challenge is for jurors to understand the law and the concept of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that something that you see emerging as you look at many different cases and how they turn out?
The word reasonable is one of those very interesting terms that different people perceived differently. Now, what's reasonable to one person is not reasonable to another. Or what is harmful or hazardous to one is not harmful or hazardous to another. It's that example I gave about people who tend to identify with plaintiffs in auto trials are much more likely to think, the world is just full of huge hazards out there. I have to be aware of all these hazards, and I ought to be very clearly warned about them and very clearly informed how to avoid them. And then if they think that a product or a vehicle or something the manufacturer hasn't adequately warned or instructed on how to avoid, then they're going to think, this is unreasonably dangerous. So it's really interesting. This point I've made is that different types of people perceive different worlds, so they tell different stories about what's going on. And that's why I think the attorneys have to think like a juror instead of like a judge. And also, I think you asked about judges' instructions. There's so much evidence that judges' instructions just go over jurors' heads. Mm-hmm. The recent El Chapo trial, I think the judge gave, I read this, 3 hours of instructions, and jurors had to decide on 54 different verdict questions, and it took them, I think, 7 days to do that. But lots of research suggests that judges' instructions would be better understood if they were put at the beginning of a trial instead of at the end of all the evidence. Because when you think about it, the instructions are to really telling a jury, like, this is what you have to find to prove guilt or innocence. And so they should know that at the outset, because that would help them decide what to attend to, instead of after weeks of evidence and hearing, let's say, an hour of judges' instructions and finally thinking, oh, I think I see what I'm supposed to have done.
Hmm. We're talking with Drury Sherrod about his book, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And let's go to the phones, and Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I was on a very interesting trial one time. A man and a woman had been living together but not married for close to 30 years. The man died and left a will giving to the woman a valuable violin, a sum of money, and many personal effects. But he reserved the the majority of his worldly goods to his brothers and sisters. Well, the woman pressed a suit claiming that she had loved him, cooked for him, cleaned for him, and took care of him in his final illness for 30 years, and therefore she should be entitled to his property as a common law wife. Well, we went to deliberate eventually, and a very high-powered type A personality man, obviously an executive of some kind, took charge of the jury and really manipulated the whole thing. It was very obvious he was eager to get out of there. It turned out that that because this man had left a will, clearly elucidating in the will what he wanted his lover to have, that was paramount, and therefore the woman would only get those things, and therefore she lost her suit. Now, every other woman in the room voted that she should get half the property. I was the only woman who voted with this high-powered type man because I truly did feel that he had clearly pointed out what he wanted her to have. So when we left that room, every other woman was extremely angry with me and talked to me very harshly.
And I'm going to leave it there, Nancy, because we're getting a little short on time. Thank you for giving us that insight into your experience. James on Facebook says he served on a jury for a civil case involving the family of a child and an insurance company fighting over money paid out for a dog bite. He says, I had a feeling some of the jurors on the side that eventually found for the insurance company were letting their own personal political beliefs get in the way of the facts. I probably should have told the judge, but for some reason, I didn't. And Drury, it's interesting because it's clear from our caller and from our Facebook commenter that, you know, we're not going in there as blank slates. We are going into a deliberation with a whole set of experiences and perspectives.
No, using the story model, the fact is it influenced the stories we tell are called stored scripts. They're scripts about similar events from our own lives. So as soon as we start hearing of the case, as I said earlier, that's when we start thinking, well, yeah, you know, if this was a dog bite case, you know, I had a similar dog bite case, and my neighbor told me about a dog. And so they start telling us. Then what's really interesting is in deliberations, almost half of what jurors say was never mentioned in court. It's just anecdotes from their own lives that help support the verdict they reached.
Drury, I'm curious, if you were charged with a crime and had the choice, would you go before a jury or would you opt for a bench trial?
I would go before a jury. I mean, first, the reason is that it's an error to see judges or arbitrators or mediators as free of bias. They are just as biased because they have the same brains that jurors do. They also resort to stories. They just may resort to different types of stories, but they're not bias-free. And if you accept that they're not bias-free, then I think it's much better to spread the bias across 6 to 12 people who you would find on a jury instead of vesting it in one expert, one arbitrator, or one judge. And additionally, we've done, when in my jury research firm, when we were preparing attorneys for bench trials, we would hire panels of retired judges, and they would get dense packets of information, they would listen to the case, they would deliberate, and then they would reach verdicts in questionnaires. And analyzing the questionnaires showed that judges would split among themselves about which side was right or wrong, and when they did decide jointly that one side was right, they would have different reasons for deciding it. So judges are just as biased as humans and arrive at just as diverse reasons and decisions and probably from their own lives.
Well, Drury, thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Drury Sherrod is the co-founder of Matson & Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategy and jury selection. His latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them.
And you can keep the conversation going on Twitter. If you've ever served on a jury, tell us about your experience. Did you leave feeling better or worse about our justice system? Do you think the jury system needs to be overhauled? If so, how? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.